Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager of the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. So today's session, we're looking at top tips for reptile consultations, and I think as you go through and you're doing consultations, you sort of fall into traps and things as you go along. You redefine how you're going to pose questions, how you're going to ask questions to get the best out of people. And I guess this webinar is about really what pitfalls I've fallen into, and try and give you some ideas of how to avoid those from the outset. That means you come across more eloquent to the owner. And I think the first thing you've got to, when you're dealing with any animal coming into the clinic, is you kind of do have to know your species. And I guess if you're looking at what's coming in, maybe there's a dozen or 15 common reptile species, the vast majority of which are going to be coming in to see you. And so on the left, for example, on this picture, I've just put a bearded dragon in there. These sort of things should be automatically something you know and recognize off the bat. But of course, there's about another 7,000-8,000 species out there that maybe aren't coming in so frequently. And I think it's fair to be fair, you've got a collection of different people coming in. You've got pet owners who, if they've got a slightly unusual species that maybe isn't within your normal remit, they would expect you to know that, because they are still common species. Much as they're not in the top 12, they're still going to be there. Moving across to then having specialist breeders who maybe have got more unusual species, and you might not be expected to know exactly what they're bringing in. But obviously, if you don't know what's coming in, for example, on the right here, we've got an ornate Nile monitor. If you don't know the exact subspecies, you may be at a disadvantage when the owner's presenting to you, because it doesn't look like you really are the expert that maybe they were hoping to be seeing. So I think if you're having slight anticipation of what is coming in, am I going to recognize it, am I going to know what's going on, then you've got to look at a way of getting that information beforehand. And the good thing is when these people are going to phone for a consultation on the phone, and your reception or nursing staff that are taking that call, they're not going to be expected to know the species that's coming in. So if you can train reception to find out what type of lizard Fluffy is when it's coming into, then that's great. Some owners, some receptionists, if they're busy, they'll know a lizard is coming in. The owner might try and explain what it is. They misspell it. They mishear it. So they just go down for, oh, well, it's a lizard of some sort. I'm sure you'll work it out. That's obviously a missed opportunity here. So train your reception staff. They've got a lizard coming in. What species do you have? What is it? What's its colour more? Things like that. Get them to spell it out. The number of times we'll have things put through spelled incorrectly or just completely strange, because your reception team maybe don't know the full range of different groups and names of reptiles, for example. So spell it out, write it down. This is your chance to find out exactly what that is, and your reception should do that for you. If they fail at that point and it still is marked on the system as a reptile is coming to see you, then again, when it presents into the clinic, once again, your reception nursing staff still are probably not expected to know exactly what that animal is. So this is another opportunity for you to try and work out what has appeared in the box. Reception can just ask. They can be enthusiastic. Oh, what have you got in there? I'd really like to know what's going on. And then the owners would normally do a combination of either telling them what's in there, or in some cases, depending on the nature of the beast, that I've chosen a venomous snake at the top here. And in the bottom here, we've got a rather grumpy monitor lizard. Again, these aren't things your clients are necessarily going to be showing that owner. But let's suggest it was a little frilled dragon. This sort of type thing. They would probably go, oh, yeah, this is my frilled lizard. It's called Freddy or something. And they might even show them and get excited about their pet. and demonstrate that to reception, which is great because then reception can amend the clinical notes accordingly, the clinical records accordingly, to ensure you've got that right species. Again, you've got a little bit of a heads up of what's coming in. Your last chance, I guess, at trying to work out what species you've got is we know that reptiles are ectothermic. We know they're reliant on an appropriate thermal environment to keep them warm. That's paramount. And they do need to be kept warm. A lot of owners that are presenting reptiles to you, they are concerned about the temperature of that reptile because it's travelled in the car, it's in the waiting room, and all this sort of type thing. So they do get concerned about that. So if you can train your reception when this animal appears in its box, they know it's a reptile coming in. You could always train reception to say, okay, let's get this animal admitted. It's cold. We want to warm it up. What we can do is we can take it, we can pop it into one of our tanks out the back. We can warm this reptile while you're waiting. And then obviously it's in the building. And certainly when you're marketing and selling this to the clients, you can't do a clinical examination on a cold reptile. They've got to be warm. Can't get blood out of them, for example, because they've just shut down their peripheral circulation. So there's lots of very positive reasons for warming this. Of course, what you can do, having got it admitted into your VIV, is you run out back. You have a quick look at the animal, a subjective assessment, if you like, and go, what is this? Work out what species you've got, of course, which is helpful based on what information the receptionist has got. And to some extent, if you're seeing them in that circumstance, of course, if they're collapsed, moribund, you can perhaps instigate something to sort that out. Conversely, you could have a little bit of a clinical examination while you're there, before you've seen the owner, without taking the clinical history, because that might then tempt you into having an idea of what's going on with that lizard before you chat to them in consult, and that might help you actually target some of your clinical history questioning. If you're thinking this animal's clearly got metabolic bone disease, well, then maybe when I go into consultation, I'm going to get my history as I would do, but I'm going to focus on the things that have concerned me from what was a superficial clinical assessment in the first instance. But obviously, after all these time points, having worked out what you've got, now is the time you go on to Google. Now you go, right, I don't know what sort of environment a frilled lizard lives in. Let's find out. Let's type that into Google and give a very quick overview of how this animal lives and the sort of questions I'm going to need to ask. So it does buy you a little bit of time, but really, realistically, this is your last chance because when that animal is presented in the consult room to you, and you go, oh, what have you got in the box there? More than likely, the owner is going to take the animal out of that box, or they would have already done so before you've even spoken to them because they just thrust the animal at you in a sort of desperate attempt for you to help them. But they will expect you to know as soon as it magically appears. It's unusual for an owner to go, oh, yes, it's a colour variant of a green iguana that I've got in my box here. Look, I'll show you next. They present you with the animal and they expect you to know. And if you don't know, then obviously that's a negative thing in terms of the owner's perception of you in the consult. And of course, if you haven't got access to Google easily, well, one would hope you've got a series of books sitting out the back. We've just put MADA here, BSFA Manual of Reptiles, because they're two standard sort of texts you'll have. Not very good at telling you different species, unfortunately. What you really need is a illustrated atlas of species to work from, but obviously you've got to have a good idea of what you're looking for to know which page to search on. So, and if you've got absolutely no idea what's presented to you, then obviously it is very difficult. So, getting the right species from the get-go, critically, critically important, because you can't really ask the right questions in the consult without knowing what you're dealing with. So, having got the animal in the room now, hopefully knowing what animal it is. And if you don't, well, then you've got to hope that when you open the box, you do know what it is. The next thing I would say when you're looking at reptiles, and this is a standard problem that everybody gets, is they take time. If you're going to take a detailed clinical history of this animal, it consumes a lot of your time. And on the busy evening clinic, maybe you don't have that time. So I always have a quick look in the box for a collection of reasons. The first thing is if this animal is critically ill, my priority is saving that critical ill patient. I can justify that to my client and say, look, this animal's really collapsed. I've got to get it in, get it sorted out, and get it warmed up first. Get a consent form signed, etc., etc. But get it in and start doing things to save the animal. The clinical history, I can take that at some point in the future. But what I need to do is get my animal out back. So maybe that's going to save you time if you're pushed for time and you'll get a history later. Or maybe you want to get a consent form signed, get the animal in the hospital, direct your other staff that are dealing with inpatients to sort that out, and then you can go back and take a clinical history about the animal while they're warming and putting in the catheter or whatever they're doing to that patient. So this might save you time in the consult, but alternatively is making sure that animal is cared for. I suppose the second reason that I would look into this box is if it's critically ill and you look at that and go, this needs to be euthanized. If this is an individual pet housed at home and you're euthanizing it, there is no point taking a protracted clinical history because you're euthanizing that. And okay, some owners might have presented it for euthanasia, which makes your life easy because they're geared up and ready for that. But in a lot of cases, they'll be presented for a consultation. You look at it, and on the basis of your subjective assessment, you go, no, this is one that isn't going to work. This is one I cannot save here. I've got to guide this owner during my questioning and my consultation to be thinking that euthanasia is in the best interest of this animal, to progress in that direction. And again, that may save you time. If it's going to be euthanized, there is no point taking a protracted clinical history from the animal. Now, okay, maybe they're going to get another one. Maybe they're going to think about another reptile in the future. Then this is where you will be pushing out care sheets to them. And again, even if staying in as an inpatient, you could push your care sheets out and say, look, obviously husbandry hasn't been quite right. I know we haven't chatted about it yet. This is our advice that we would recommend for you if you're going to consider getting the next one. And obviously then you're looking at them coming in, presenting that at post-purchase examination, going through their husbandry with them. So maybe in both these circumstances, this is more a care sheet situation than a protracted clinical history needing to be taken. And depending on the circumstances, if at all possible, get this reptile warm while you're taking the history. And to some extent, if you do train your receptionist to take them out the back and pop them somewhere warm, it's good practice. It's bespoke care for that animal. It gives you a chance to have a look at it, how bad it is, how healthy it is, and what species you've got. There's a whole variety of reasons for taking that animal, popping it out the back while you're taking the history for that patient, and that of course is very, very relevant. When it comes to taking the clinical history from these species, it is absolutely impossible for you to learn about every single reptile, their individual care. You just cannot do that with this number of species, and I wouldn't expect anybody to even try to do that. Okay, the common species, yep, you need to know what's going on with those by default, and that's relatively easy, I guess. But all the other more unusual species, you've got to pigeonhole those into a set group. So, for example, when I'm looking at a novel species coming in, and I'm going through Google, I'm going through a book, what I need to do is to break it down into just some common sense points about that. So I can say, great, okay, you're a diurnal basking species that's feeding on invertebrates. That I can deal with, okay? Or you're a nocturnal rainforest species that's eating vegetation. I need to sort of put you into those different groups, and then I can ask sensible questions that, okay, maybe they aren't tailored to the exact requirements of that individual. They will get me enough within that ballpark to get a feel for if that husbandry is okay. So the first thing, obviously, with the reptiles we're concerned about is heat. They are all ectotherms. They all require external heat sources to maintain their core body temperature. Most of the species you're dealing with are going to be taking radiation heat to warm them up, maybe some conductive heat as well. But essentially, you've got to set up an environment that allows them to do this. And realistically, you're going to be looking at having basking lamps for the vast majority of species that you're dealing with to enable them to warm up. But of course, for all these species, we've got to have a thermal gradient. Within that thermal gradient, they've got to be able then to thermoregulate. So you've got to have a warm end, you've got to have a cold end, and realistically, that's what you're dealing with for most of your species. And I wouldn't worry too much about your basking temperature. A lot of people get very excited about the exact temperature that your basking spot must be. And I would more realistically put it down as it has to be as a minimum temperature, not necessarily a set temperature range. There's nothing that says for me for a reptile that if I've got a basking temperature and I measure directly below that heat bulb and it's measuring, say, 45 degrees, I don't have to sit at 45 degrees. I can sit to the side at 42 or a bit further away at 35 if I want. Practically, realistically, most reptiles will sit at the hottest point under a basking site because the quicker I heat up, the quicker I move away and go about my business and I've achieved my optimal metabolic rate. So, to some extent, your temperature of your basking site, as long as it's above a minimum, is kind of okay. What you do have issues with some of the very potent basking sites, is the risk of overheating in a small enclosure like we've got here on the left. And obviously, your concern then is if the entire environment is pushing too hot, then that's a dead reptile that I've got here. And certainly, this is a major factor with some of the animals in captivity. And we just have a look here at a pet shop here, for example, where we've got a very small setup here. We've got chelonians in here, and you're like, how can you get a proper thermal gradient in this sort of setup for them? It's just not possible. So the little tricks that people will do to avoid overheating in a small setup as this, the first thing that they might do is put the heat lamp on a thermostat. I mean, they've got to, they have no choice. If they have the heat lamp running without that, they're going to overheat the enclosure and you've got a dead reptile. So if they have this basking site on a thermostat, the chances are they've got no choice because the enclosure is too small. Lack of ventilation, maybe, all these sorts of things. And the downside of doing that, of course, is my basking lamp isn't on all the time. I can't choose to bask when I want. I can only bask when it's on. And if my enclosure is that small, I don't have a thermal gradient anymore. So realistically, you don't want your basking sites on a thermostat. You need an enclosure that's big enough that allows a decent thermal gradient to occur. So, and again, this is just one sort of setup here. Again, not the best in the world, but we've got a slightly larger setup here for this little red foot. We can get a thermal gradient in here. Would be nice if we had the UV tube actually in the UV fitment, but that's another story. But again, you just got to try and get a feel for that. And certainly when you're going through looking at setups, a lot of people now will have pictures, videos, everything on their iPad or phone with them. Make use of all of that material. A picture such as this, for example, shown on a phone, answers 20 questions I would otherwise be asking in the consult room. Great, this does help me very much in terms of working at what's going on with that patient. The next thing, of course, you've got when you're looking at mistakes made with heat environment is thermal burns. Very, very commonly due to heat mats in the wrong direction or lamps not being protected, animals getting too close to them, the surface temperature bulbs can get very, very high. So again, common pitfall that people will have in captive husbandry. You've got to question that to try and work out what's going on here. But normally, if you've got burns, you're going to be fairly evident on presentation where and what you're dealing with. The next pitfall, which is a very common one, certainly that I will be seeing in Scotland here, is a lot of animals are just too cold. And sometimes getting that information out of the owner can actually be quite difficult to do that. And I thought I'd stop and pause for a bit here and just go through a little bit around really the sort of things that we're looking at to the advice that I give, or the questions that I'm asking to try and find out if there is a temperature problem in the setup. So when owners come to me and they say, "Oh yes, my temperature's fine, this, that, and all the other," and they go through all of it and they relay to you the warm end temperatures and the temperatures that it's at the cold end, and then you say, "Okay, well, what's the overnight temperatures?" And they relay to you their overnight temperatures. And a lot of the time, I sit there and think these owners are just lying, not out of intention, but they just don't know. So one of the questions that I will be posing to the owners is saying, how warm is your house at 3 o'clock in the morning? How warm is this tank at 3 o'clock in the morning, where your reptile is living? And of course, the answer then is, well, they're asleep. And the temperature of your viv will very quickly cool down to room temperature. And certainly, if you're promoting tortoise tables and open-topped setups for the chelonians, then that clearly is falling to room temperature pretty much automatically. And so, because they have no idea what the room temperature at 3 o'clock in the morning, you don't know whether this animal's warm enough or not. And you certainly will see the heat sources that they have in this tortoise table, say for example, that will fail to hold the temperature of that setup despite being on continuously. And their central heating isn't reliable. And everybody will say, "Oh yes, the central heating's on, I leave it on overnight, so it's perfectly fine." And then the question is can we trust central heating? So more and more these days, I'm going through giving a little tutorial on how central heating works. So the sort of discussion that I have at this time point now, having been kind of forced into it really, the first thing here is to say, okay, you have a boiler, it heats water to a set temperature that you're setting on a dial on your boiler. And that water temperature might be 6 degrees, might be 70 degrees, might be 80 degrees, but it's something like that. And that is how hot your hot water is that you're running out of your tap. What you then have is a thermostat, normally in the hall, in the landing, something like that, where you are setting the room temperature of that hall or landing. Okay? And this then basically, when it gets too cold, this activates the boiler to send the hot water to flow to the radiators in the house. And what you have on your radiators is a TRV valve, okay, a thermostatic radiator valve. And all this does is determine how much hot water flows into that radiator. If it's on one, it's a trickle. If it's on three, it's on full blast. And that determines how much hot water goes into the radiator and then obviously how that heats the room. So the temperature of that room is completely dependent on how hot your hot water is, how much flow is going into the radiator, and what the room temperature was in the first place, and the relative size of your radiator, for example. So if this animal is in the lounge and you have got one small radiator in there and you've set it at, you've got the flow rate on the TRV maybe on the setting two, the temperature of your landing or your hall, because you've shut the door between your hall and your lounge, has no bearing on that. If your hall is a relatively smallish space that heats up quite quickly with a radiator in there, that's going to click off the flow to all the radiators in the house before your lounge has achieved the temperature that you thought it did. Equally, if you've got your temperature put in your hall and the radiator's turned right down on the TRV, maybe your lounge will heat more than you thought compared to your hall. So you cannot guarantee the overnight temperature in a room on your central heating. If you want to find out what the temperature is, relying on your central heating thermostat in the hall or landing is absolutely pointless. You've got to put a max min thermometer in that viv. And then when I come down in the morning and I've sort of reset it, I can go, how cold did you get last night? And that'll give me the genuine temperature in there. It'll let me know how good or bad my central heating is being at holding that temperature. And like I say, if you've got a tortoise table, you're completely dependent in most cases on that overnight temperature from your central heating. Bearing in mind, if you think, oh, I'll just leave a little lamp in the middle on here, just under a red bulb, so the tortoise can just get a bit of heat, the tortoise isn't basking underneath that red bulb. The tortoise is going to the corner of the box and digging in and staying there. And the temperature in the corner of that box probably has no bearing of the temperature that is under the red lamp where the tortoise isn't sitting because it's not basking, it's digging in the corner. And if I move my red lamp over to the corner, great, the chances are the tortoise will choose to sleep in the opposite corner tonight. So when we're looking at trying to maintain temperatures in the open box tortoise tables, they're a nightmare. And realistically for these, you do need a bed area, and you need your tortoise to be in that bed area overnight, and you need a way of holding the temperature in that bed area to keep it warm enough for that tortoise. The other thing you can do, which is quite cool, is you can just go out and get a data logger. These are marketed for monitoring chilled transport, fridges, things like that. But they will give you a genuine, how cold were you? How long was it that cold for? So you get a, instead of just having a maximum minimum, you get a full range of temperatures, which of course is great. And this is just one little graph here from a few years ago now, just looking at room temperature here. So this actually is, it was my tortoises that were actually in an outside shed at this time, had heating and things in there, but this really was just showing you how this room temperature varied on a daily and obviously week by week basis, given the external temperature. And what we can see on here is we have a bit of a cold snap here, and there's a marked drop in generalized room temperature. So this is based from the, I guess, temperature coming up from the heat lamp during the day. And obviously overnight, we can see here the temperature has dropped down lower than on the other days here. So my heat sources at this time point were starting to fail. If I wanted my tortoises to be, say, minimum of 10, ideally minimum of 15 degrees overnight, you can see we were doing quite fine at this point. But as soon as the temperature dropped, my heat sources failed to hold overnight temperature. And the other interesting point when we're looking at this as well is this now is the logger was kept in the same position here. So this is for basking temperature now, with the same heat lamp on, same length of time, same wattage. And what you've got an interest here is obviously you can look here as aiming for a temperature of say 40 degrees, which is a reasonable sort of basking temperature for a Chelonian. Great, 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 great. The air temperature in the shed dropped markedly due to outside temperature dropping. So during the day, when maybe my background heat sources weren't on, because obviously the general temperature in the tank was warmer due to the heat lamp, and so the overnight sources, which were aiming at keeping the temperature above 10 or 15 degrees, hadn't activated at this point, look. But the basking temperature dropped down to 25 on the coldest day, despite having been 40 just a couple of weeks beforehand, simply due to air temperature and air movement. So if your basking lamp is set at the same distance day in, day out, but you've got changes in air temperature in that unit, the temperature at the basking site at the reptile level will vary. So realistically, this stabs at you've got to raise that background environmental temperature, hold that consistently in order for your basking lamp to have the same level. And that comes back to if you've got them in a shed, you've got obviously in this circumstance something else had to be done to raise that temperature up. If it's in the house, then okay, you need to make sure your central heating is on consistently all day long to try and maintain an even temperature if you believe it's doing that effectively. So if you want to avoid overnight cooling, excessive cooling, then you've got to come up with a different plan. This setup here, not ideal again, and we actually got the owners to change that. They got some little star tortoises up here, the red lamp here, no UV, but that's another story. But this actually was for sulcata, and this here actually takes them outside to a paddock. They come through the plastic sheeting, which I think is quite nice, into here. The one heat lamp is a bit pathetic, we changed that. But obviously, the owners had massive issues maintaining overnight temperature in this setup for their tortoises. So the central heating was brought in as sort of a bit of a help here. And again, this came as from the house. They just sort of put it out into the shed as well. But obviously, you can see that this is not going to be a fail-safe system for maintaining overnight temperature. It's going to help, but they probably need something else than just that to keep this room warm enough. This setup here, basking lamp on during the day, great. Here's your background heat being provided by this tubular heater, which works quite well out of the way of the tortoise as well. The question is that going to do the job well enough? And that comes back to logging temperatures and recording temperatures. And of course, you've got other for vivs and things inside, you've got reptile radiators, mats, other sort of things you can do to push up and maintain temperature in a viv in the house sort of situation. Other things you just have to have a little bit of a think about during your consultation too is whether they are sun loving or they heat up from contact. And that boils down to then what you put in around your basking site, how big a gradient that you want, how potent a basking site that you need, and that's obviously species dependent. And a lot of people with a lot of species, like the snakes or geckos and things, won't even give them the opportunity to have a basking site or a slightly warmer area, feeling that these species don't bask. But of course, they do. This rattlesnake, much as it is sitting in a hot area of rocks, pushing itself against all of the rocks, it's in full sunlight, currently basking. The next thing, common errors that people make, common questionings that you've got to go through and ask is, we've got to think about vitamin D synthesis. We know metabolic bone disease is one of the commonest things you're going to see out there. So I need to make sure that I've got my head around the vitamin D cycle. But equally then, I've got to target my questions to try and make sure I'm happy that this entire system is functioning adequately. And obviously that's, again, takes a little bit of skill to try and work that out. So we know when we're looking at the reptiles, their natural exposure is going to vary. If you've got diurnal species that are arid, desert dwelling, we know they're going to have a high natural exposure. And maybe this fits a lot of the species you're seeing in captivity. We know if they are nocturnal species, rainforest species, then maybe lower. Obviously, if you're in the rainforest canopy, then like a green iguana, that's different to being a red-footed tortoise, for example, on the canopy floor. We also know the vast majority of species you're seeing can use UVB, and we do know that a lot of the common species you're seeing, they actually have an absolute requirement for it. And this, to me, is a backup plan for a poor diet, which we're going to have a little discussion on pros and cons for that next. So we've got to make sure that they understand this. We've got to make sure that that's done right. And there's a few common errors that people do that you need to sort of go through and look at. We know it diminishes over distance. So you've got to get how far away is this from that and work that out. We know that glass, plastic, mesh, they're going to filter it all out. So you've got to ask the right sort of questions to confirm, is this in, if they say it's in the top of the tank, great, but do they mean on the top of the tank, or is it inside the tank below the top, but at the top of the inside bit? You've got to really try and clarify that. Obviously, how often you're changing your bulb is very, very important. We've got to change them frequently. They've got to be close to the reptiles as well. And we need to make sure that they are getting adequate amounts of UV to make us happy. And again, classical sort of scenario, oh yes, the tortoise, they get plenty of light. They're in a greenhouse. And you're like, they're getting plenty of light, but they're not getting plenty of UVB. So in this sort of circumstance where you're struggling, I normally default back to the end and say, okay, do you get sunburnt when you're driving in the car? Do you get sunburnt in your conservatory or your summer house? And the answer is, of course, no, I don't. It's like, right, so you're not getting UV exposure. To do that, you've got to have direct unfiltered sunlight. And that's normally quite a good trick to get them to realize that as a concept. Having gone through that, you've got to work out what UV light source they've got. And I've just put a few up here now. On the left here, we've got a compact lamp. And for me, they do what they say on, says on the tin, as it were. They're good for a small enclosure. You've then got mercury vapor in the middle here. We've got a metal halide top right. And obviously, a collection of fluorescent tubes on the bottom right here. So you need to work out what they've got. And one little pitfall, which actually very nearly caught me out when you're discussing these, is a lot of people don't know what bulb they've got, but they probably will remember where they got it from or the, how much it cost them. So if you're looking at any of a UV producing bulb, then clearly you do know it's going to cost 20 quid, 30 quid, 40 quid. It's going to be a certain amount of money. I had one client once who basically rescued a tortoise, tortoise table set up, everything done. We had a long chat about UV, and he was like, oh yes, it's had a, you know, a compact bulb in there, which I needed to go and change because, you know, I was aware of that. So he said, so, you know, I put a new bulb in there straight away. And I was like, brilliant, lovely. I said, what bulb did you get? He went, oh, I got a Philips. So I was sitting there thinking, oh, okay, he seems quite knowledgeable. And obviously, Philips market a lot of tubes that they produce for other companies that will be UV producing. And I thought, okay, he's just gone and got a generic UV producing bulb without paying the extra money for, you know, having a reptile picture on it. I thought, well, that's probably okay. And he just basically went through the whole thing, and then he sort of went through it all, and it finally dawned on me. I said, oh, I said, that's an Ursulus. Where did you get it from? And his response was, he named a supermarket. And you're like, you've just gone to the local supermarket and bought an energy saving bulb because it looked the same as the compact UV bulb you've taken out. And we've had this whole discussion about UV with him, and it, all the nodding and yesing and agreeing, and seemed quite informative. It's like, you've just bought an energy saving bulb for 2 quid from your local supermarket. Almost an incredulous response. And I guess it was me making the assumption, given the discussion, that this person was going to do it right. And just at the last minute, it was like, yeah. So make sure you are completely happy. You know, we've had people, for example, putting in UV fluorescent tubes. They've gone and got actinic tubes designed for fish that give out UVA and have no UVB output. You know, these are things you've got to try and work on to figure that out. And when we're looking at UV, and this is just a very bad picture of mine, but if we look at sunlight, it's producing UVB, UVA, and visible light. Okay, some of your tubes marketed will be giving UVA and visible light, but not UVB, and others may be giving full spectrum visible lighting, but no UVA, UVB. Make sure you are very clear what bulb they have got. Don't fall into that trap. And a lot of these are marketed as contains UV light, and it's a sun bulb, and you're like, that's not giving UVB. So you need to be very, very clear on that. And the point for my very poor graph here, to some extent, is to say that incandescent bulbs, which are in yellow, and the red bulbs in red, aren't necessarily bad things because these produce light towards the red end of the spectrum, your UV tubes in a lot of cases that are marketed as producing light more towards the blue end of the spectrum. And if you added the red bulb spectrum to a UV spectrum, you're balancing out that light level that maybe approximates sunlight a bit better than just having the UV itself. So don't reject these other bulbs completely. They may actually be helping to extend the spectrum of lighting and making it more natural relative to a very blue skewed environment for your reptiles. Of course, the other thing we've got here now to think about too is diet. If we've kind of gone through and hopefully negotiated the pitfalls of UV here, and we're happy that their temperatures are being maintained, this obviously is complemented with diet for these really to some extent. And there's a big difference between, like the tortoise on the left here, outside in the sun, eating dandelions that clearly have been growing in the garden. That's completely different to a tortoise inside under artificial UV on a salad mixture here with eating tomatoes as well, which nutritionally are completely different. So when you're going through looking at their feeding designs, you've got to think about what are you actually eating and the nutritional value of that. When we're looking at things that you would do to your diet to improve its quality for them, the first thing you're going to be looking at is going to be looking at gut loading. And if you're feeding invertebrates, for example, these will need to be gut loaded immediately prior to being fed out to the reptiles. And you've got to get a high level of calcium into these before they're going to have any real impact in the calcium to phosphorus ratio of that invertebrate species you're dealing with. And obviously, a lot of the commercial products out there may fail to get adequate levels of calcium. So, I've had people that have come in and gone, "Oh, yes, I bought gut loaded crickets from the local wherever," and you're like, but they've sat there for a couple of 3 days. The gut loading doesn't really have any effect now. So you want instant gut loading before they've been fed to stand a chance at getting that level adequate. The next thing you've got here, of course, then you're moving on now to dusting of this food. All of the food needs to be dusted. If the owner is selectively dusting at some days, then maybe you're encouraging some selective feeding from the animal. So I would encourage dusting continuously for all these species to give you a chance of getting sufficient on there, and obviously targeting calcium as well. And when we're thinking back to nutrition in these, if you're feeding invertebrates that have been dusted, they will groom off supplement from that dusting within 1 to 2 minutes. If you've gut loaded them and they've got a GI tract full of lovely high calcium vegetation in there, instead of people using banana, apple, or something else, again, something that's inherently low calcium to try and supplement the calcium content of something that is already low calcium. But they're going to pass those contents out as well. And equally, of course, if you're leaving your invertebrate prey in the tank, then they might bite that gecko. They might spread pinworms and things around because they can do. So realistically, when you're trying to get an angle on, are they gut loading? Are they dusting? That's all very well and good. I need to know that that gut loading and that powder is going into your reptile, and how you're feeding it is quite critically important. So you may have to spend some time saying, okay, I want you to start hand feeding this. I want this animal to be eating these with gusto, and you're removing all spare live food from that tank to ensure that they are getting the supplementation on that. And those, of course, can be difficult to do. And this is why when you're looking at species that don't necessarily need UV but are capable of benefiting from UV, then obviously giving them that opportunity to have it is quite important. And what you also have to account when you're looking at UV is they might not intentionally bask under it. So we had a scenario where many years ago now I had green iguanas in a butterfly setup in a butterfly exhibit. Brilliant. Loads of space, lots of climbing, lots of vegetation. The environment was kept nice and warm. They could bask on a sunny day. But of course, they were getting absolutely zero UVB. There was no way of getting these iguanas to bask under a UV light source, because if you put one up, they just bask wherever the sun was heating it up the warmest, which would probably be warmer than your UV spot source. So much as this was a lovely sort of situation to put them in, you couldn't make them bask under the UV. And in those circumstances, they had to come out of the enclosure and be set up in a proper viv, not in a proper viv, but in a setup where they had to go and bask under the UV. So you kind of have to think a little bit about, I guess, enforced UV exposure, or at least making sure your UV basking sites are the warmest basking sites that they have access to. And I had another tortoise owner that was having 250 watt pig lamps they were using for their sulcatas, which obviously is giving a lot of great heat. Brilliant, lovely setup. And I said, well, you ought to be getting some more UV into these. Maybe you want to switch in and put some UV producing mercury vapor lamps in here, which they did. And the feedback I got from the client was that the tortoises hated them. And I was like, what do you mean they hate them? They're brilliant. They said, well, I put them in and they're just continuing to bask under the red bulbs. They don't want to bask under the UV bulbs. And then, of course, it dawned on me and I just went, what's the temperature, what's the wattage of your UV bulbs you put in? Oh, it's 150 watt. And it's like, so you've set up colder basking sites with UV and warmer basking sites without UV. Of course, the tortoise is going to go to the warmest site it can, because this is the whole point we've had on our discussion today, I guess. So then I said, well, okay, you've got big sulcatas. One bulb actually probably isn't big enough anyway. Move your UV spots next to your red lamps. You're going to have a more diffuse heating area, more even heating, less risk of, I guess, if it was a, certainly if you're looking at some of the lizards, for example, and bigger snakes, less risk of a thermal burn. But obviously, then they're getting UV and heat at the same time from the same spot area. But of course, what they needed to do, because they had multiple animals, was have multiple spots, all of which matched in temperature. If you put four spots into a setup, in a setup for animals, they will all congregate around the warmest, unless they're all of even temperature at the reptile level, where they're basking. So lots of silly little things that can happen that will throw you off until you start getting more and more experienced at eking out the right history from people. And again, when you're looking back, sorry for the sidetrack, going back and looking at dusting, and you want to make sure they're dusting with an appropriate very high calcium to phosphorus ratio product, or just straight calcium carbonate for a lot of these species, alongside that. And while you're thinking of diet, try and encourage them to grow them themselves, or use weeds for a lot of these species, for the chelonians particularly here. But certainly, if you're going to gut load your invertebrates, gut load your invertebrates with dandelions too. You've got to think about the quality of the nutrition source they're putting into the situation. And just a brief thought on substrate, reptiles will eat anything that is on the floor of that tank. It can be stones, it can be a spring. We had one family once where the children were hand feeding their leopard tortoise that lived around the house. They were hand feeding it plastic, buttons, washers, anything. Hilarious that the tortoise would eat it, until you x-ray it and say, what has happened here? Completely unknown to the owner that their small children had been feeding it all sorts of funny things. Crayons was going in as well. So whatever these are going to sit on, they will eat it. And that's again a critical point that you have to think about. And just because it's been marketed doesn't mean to say it's safe. So you've got to go through that, nail down exactly what substrate they've got it on. And in many cases, if it's wood chip or whatever, your advice is get it off that substrate now. This is not what we would be recommending. And I think a lot of people get very cross when they go to a pet shop or pet store and they buy a product that you then don't recommend. It's almost creating a poor relationship to some extent with you in the local pet shop, because you've advised against that. And I think the message that I send back to owners is, any business stocks products that sells. If people are daft enough to buy it, somebody will sell it, and they are in business in the end of the day. If I go to my local supermarket and I decide I'm going to buy just chocolate and an energy drink and I'm going to live off that for the rest of my life, then that's my problem. Nobody advised me to buy that. Nobody told me that was healthy. I chose to buy it. And I think there's a big difference if I went to a focus group that was being run by that supermarket and I said, look, I'm concerned about my diet. What do you think would be the best sort of diet I should have? And they go, well, you should be eating fruit and veg and this and that and all the other. Great. I've been told if that focus group said, oh, I'd have energy drinks and chocolate, then clearly there's a problem there. So a lot of people that go to the pet shops that pick something off the shelf and buy it without asking advice, that's their problem. If they choose to go to that pet shop and seek appropriate advice from a member of staff to say, okay, this is the animal I got. I want you to give me your best advice on what products I should be buying and using in that environment. That's a different thing because if they then are advising products that are harmful, that's a different question. So it is quite an interesting thing to come across because most people get upset that, well, they're selling something that's not safe. And it's like, well, eating chocolate all day long isn't safe. Buying cigarettes from the supermarket isn't safe. But it's a choice that you are making for your pet. The next common thing you get when you're looking at nutritional secondary hyperparathyroidism here or metabolic bone disease is sometimes the owners fail to understand when you've got a group of animals, most classically here, it's a female that's gone into severe metabolic bone disease because she's trying to calcify eggs. And the owner goes, well, my husbandry's perfect. I've got another one that's running around without a singular problem. And it's like, but that's not an egg-laying female. And people seem to struggle when you're looking at husbandry and getting your husbandry right. Getting your husbandry right for an adult male is not the same as getting your husbandry right for an egg-laying female or a growing juvenile. There are differences in how you're going to maintain and keep those individuals depending on their physiological state. So even if you have an adult female, if she's going to start calcifying eggs, you need to ramp up your husbandry and your calcium and gut loading to match her increased requirements just at the point when she's going to go off eating because, of course, she's got a belly full of eggs. And if you're not expecting that animal to lay or breed, you haven't had the opportunity to do that. And most owners give the same husbandry all the time. They're not thinking about this. And this is why some animals get it, some animals don't. It's not that your husbandry is okay. It might be okay for a male that's not doing anything. It might be marginal. But for these females that are reproductively active, it's woefully inadequate. The next tip for trying to, I guess, convince owners that you're the person they should be taking their reptiles to is keep them yourself. If you're going through the situation and you are struggling engaging that owner, getting them across, around to your way of thinking, there's two ways you can kind of do it. One is you slip in, well, what I do with mine, just in passing into the consultation can make a big difference. Even if you're lying, if you're giving the assumption you've got reptiles, can make a difference. But it obviously does have an impact. And I think people that are seeing you with exotic pets, they instantly assume you keep them because you're that enthusiastic about them. And if you don't, they're going, oh, it's like doing equine work, but you don't ride a horse. It's a negative thing. So this actually can be very positive. Had a friend of mine who had a very, very smart idea. Used to deal with lots of rescue centres and things for the reptiles. What he would do, anything that came through that needed supportive care or building up or whatever else, he would take them on. Maybe he'd take them on for 6 months, 9 months. He'd get them back out and sorted up for the charity and then go, great, you can now rehome it off to somebody else. So he would have a massive turnover of different species that he would be helping the charity to rehabilitate, but of course he's getting a massive variety of exposure to different species in different environments over a short time span. And example I'm just putting here is this is my tortoise actually going through her entire breeding process with the incubator, and there's a little baby in here that had an egg yolk sitting in a clean cup whilst it's absorbing its egg yolk. It's just going through this sort of experience, relaying that back to the owners. It just makes you far more believable and understood by them, and something I would encourage you to do if you can do. Now, the only other way you can do this, if you're stuck and you've got an owner that's being problematic in terms of engaging with the husbandry you're trying to get them to take, if you have got an owner, a longer standing client who you know is on board, that looks after their animals well, sitting in your waiting room, some of the times it's a good thing to leave that new owner sitting next to an experienced client of yours. Leave them for 10 minutes, 20 minutes. They will start talking about what is in each other's boxes. And before you know it, that existing client of yours is giving all the information to the new client that you want that new client to have. It's not coming from you. It's not you trying to sell them stuff or do things like this. It's come from your client. And again, client evenings, things like that are great for this, for educating a client by accident, not in the consult, not consuming your time. They're picking it up from someone else who you've already had the chat to beforehand, who's sort of doing the job for you. And a few other bits and pieces that I would put on here to help you through. If you're unfamiliar with aquatic species of chelonians, just think of them as a tortoise when they're out of the water, and they're a fish when they're in water. It just makes life very simple in terms of looking at water quality and how you're going to do things. The history taken from these can be quite complicated, but just break it down into those two. Again, I'm just pigeonholing them. They are a diurnal basking species. They just happen to live in water a fair bit of the time. Another little tip for you, work out what they sell in the local shops and what they can buy online easily. Most owners will come in, they will have a white powder they're feeding. You'll ask what brand it is, you won't have an idea, so then you've got to start to describe the packaging. And if you know what Nutribar packaging looks like, or you know what Reptivite packaging looks like, then, or Arcadia lamps versus Reptiglow lamps, you'll be in a far better position then to say, okay, right, I worked out what you've got. Is it an orange and black box? Brilliant, okay, that's fine. Because you know that's what they buy from the local pet shop sales, and you know what the boxes look like. It will help you dramatically to work out this history that you're taking versus having this nondescript powder and a tube of unknown nature sitting in that tank. If you know what they've got, that's better, and that makes you appear more knowledgeable and understanding that, oh yes, I know what they sell, it's going to be this. Again, it's increasing your credibility into that consultation. Next on your list then is you're maybe progressing now at last onto doing your physical examination. First thing, make sure it's warm, and if it's not warm, then obviously have that as a limitation on your clinical assessment. State that to the owner that this reptile has come in cold, it's going to limit your physical assessment, because a cold reptile just looks awful, if that makes sense. For the students that come through, realistically on your consultation, for your subjective assessment, maybe you're looking in the box before you start taking your history, for example. But realistically, you're going to kill it, you're going to keep it, or you're going to cure it. That is your three options. We've got a cygnet turtle here, clearly quite grumpy. This is one that doesn't need to stay with me. This is one that can be going home. It looks quite bright and cheery, so I'm not worried about that becoming an inpatient. Tortoise on the right here with a prolapse oviduct, that's an inpatient. That's a keeper. That's got to stay here with me. And maybe, depending on finances and circumstances, I might be euthanizing that. But basically, have a look. Your decision really is am I going to send you home? And if I am, then I've got to take a history and come up with some presumptive treatment or rebook you in for a procedure later on down the road if it's not urgent. But I've got to go through and create something for you, send you away for you to come back or for a recheck, etc., etc. If you're going to stay with me and I'm keeping you alive, then I don't necessarily need to have a complete plan or a complete history taken, because you're staying with me, you're going to become an inpatient. And all inpatients need warming, all inpatients need hydration, all inpatients maybe need some analgesia. I can do that without necessarily engaging my brain much further I just got to convince you to leave it with me. And you know what? My priority is your reptile. I'll sort out the rest afterwards. And if I'm, of course, euthanizing you, then I'm euthanizing you. That your clinical history is, to some extent, not irrelevant, but your clinical history is not going to change my subjective decision on you're going to be euthanized now. And that, again, is a different thing. So you don't have to try and nail all this in one go. You just need to get them beyond that consult room. Next thing on my list is, if you have the opportunity, transilluminate the geckos. It's fun. It looks cool. It's quite a nice demonstration to the owners. If you're looking at a normal liver here versus severe hepatic lipidosis, this is a clinical diagnosis, and you can show the owners, and it's kind of straight there for them to see. Next thing on your clinical exam, if you can examine the cloaca, do so. Feel for kidneys, feel for impactions, feel for stones, feel for eggs, all of these things. There's lots of reasons for doing that. And if you're struggling on that and you're concerned, there's nothing to stop you putting a bird crop tube up the cloaca of a reptile to see if it's passing easily into the colon, for example, if you're thinking something's there and your finger is too big. So again, that's something quite nice to do on assessment if you can do. Other thing I would encourage to you is, if you get the chance and you can, make all your aquatic species swim. Let's see if they've got neutral buoyancy in the water. Here you're looking for GI gas on one side maybe, or lung consolidation on the other. But if you make them swim, it can be helpful. And obviously quiz them in their home environment as to what they are doing. Get a weight. Get a weight on every reptile that comes in. When you're giving supportive care, you're going to get a weight increase from them as a response to that, or response to therapy at home if they're going home. But a weight is critically important. It's objective. It can't, you know, the scales don't lie. It's going to give you a guide for how they're doing at home and how they're responding to treatment as well. So always get a weight on these guys in the consultation. And if they present things to you, make use of that. If they're going to pass feces, yep, I'll have a sample of that. For a chelonian, if they passed urine, you know what, I'm going to have a sample of that. Let's make use of this stuff. Just don't wipe it up and throw it in the bin. If you're looking at fecal screening, do wet preps and floats yourself in-house. It's very simple to do, very economical. You can get your nurses or techs to do that for you. You're going to find something. Whether it's clinically relevant to the presenting sign is another thing, but you will find something. And again, it's a bit of best practice, and it's very easy, cheap, and cheery to do in the clinical situation. And if you're looking at urine samples, again, if they present it into the clinic, what I'm looking for here, let's suggest this is a tortoise post hibernation, for example, and the owner is being a little bit reluctant in terms of letting you hang on to this tortoise for supportive care. Well, if it wheezes and I can confirm that it's got quite an acidic urine, for example, or the specific gravity is quite high, then that's a guide to the fact that it might be, you know, ketoacidotic, or it might be, you know, in catabolic, or it's quite dehydrated because the urine concentration has increased quite dramatically. If I can do that simple and easily in a consult, maybe that's just enough leverage to make the owner do what I wish them to do, which is leave the tortoise with me so I can heat you up and bathe you and start getting things going, for example. So it's a question of doing what you can in the consultation to make the client do what you wish to do. This is the end of the webinar. I've got one question that has come in for answering. And basically, when you're in a consultation and you're presenting with an owner with a garden tortoise, is the question is, what do you do? How do you get that owner to start treating that garden tortoise like a reptile, I guess? That's an interesting one. I think you've got to look at where they are, how they're housed, and things. That's all part of it. I would say the vast majority of garden tortoises that you're going to be seeing, they tend to be adult. That's the first point, so a reasonable size. And Some may be producing eggs, but a lot of be males or females that aren't reproductively active. And if you look at those and say, okay, well, where are they kept and what's going on? Well, they're outside with natural UV, and okay, I appreciate Scotland relative to Cornwall is quite a big difference here, but they do get natural UV. They're not growing, so their requirement maybe isn't quite so urgent. They're fully skeletally mature. So maybe I'm not so dramatically concerned about their UV exposure. Bearing in mind, in the winter, these garden tortoises will be hibernating anyway, so it's not like I'm concerned about them having adequate temperature during the winter or adequate UV because they've been hibernated, and that's a whole different subject area to discuss. But I'm not so worried about UV. And then if you're thinking about diet, well, most owners with them outside would be giving them maybe some top up with salads and bits and pieces, but largely they're foraging for themselves. So they're probably getting a reasonable access to weeds and things in the garden. So maybe the calcium content of the diet isn't so bad, again, given they're an adult, given they may be a male and not some actively growing either. So maybe that's not so bad. A lot of owners in that setup would probably be bathing them. They're fairly used to the need for bathing these guys, so they're getting the opportunity to have baths, and maybe they don't not so worried about hydration status. But of course, what is going to worry me with these individuals is going to be temperature. They're just exposure at the extremes of the year, and even in the summer months, depending on where they are, may be inadequate. And so for me, with those back garden tortoises that are having issues post hibernation, for example, the overriding concern is get them warmed up, get them heated, and think of a way that you can get that into the setup for them as a first instance. Because once you've done that, you're going to see a very positive response in how that animal behaves. And the owner's going to come back and going, you know what, it made a big difference. It was you warmed up really quickly and started eating very fast. You've got them sold now. They've come back to see you, and your first bit of advice made a massive impact in that animal's husbandry and welfare, I guess. Now you can start saying, well, you know what, maybe it would like some UV in the spring. Maybe we should be supplementing it a little bit on its food just so it gets a bit of extra calcium because the cuttlefish maybe you're giving is inadequate. And then you can start working on the other aspects of care. Bring out heat as your first guide for that garden tortoise, and I promise you'll be thankful. That was the first little bit of husbandry you started to push at them. Don't do everything, because if you do everything at once, you'll scare them away because they think you're crazy. You've got to work on this slow and progressively. That's the end of the webinar. I'm now going to pass you back to Eimear.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.